Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us for the first quarter of 2026 quarterly letter. The headline is "The Market in Denial." 25 years ago, CAS was founded to do one thing well: protect and compound capital over long periods of time with uncommon discipline. We have written these letters through recessions, financial crises, global pandemics, wars, and periods of irrational exuberance in all directions. If there's one lesson that runs like a thread through every one of these letters, it is this: what investors choose to ignore is almost always more dangerous than what they choose to worry about. And as we close on the books for the first quarter of 2026 and survey the landscape before us, that lesson comes to mind immediately. I'll repeat it again. What investors choose to ignore is almost always more dangerous than what they choose to worry about. So the world, has delivered several very clear signals in recent months. A conflict in the Middle East that sent energy markets into their most violent single quarter move in decades, a labor market visibly and measurably restructuring itself in ways the headline numbers do not capture, a stock market hitting new highs on the strength of an increasingly narrow group of companies, while the dividend investors collect has rarely been lower in 100 years of recorded data, and a private credit market generating more noise than signal, where nuance matters enormously but is routinely lost in all the headlines. Now, none of these are small things, and this letter gives each the detailed examination it deserves, but our goal, as it has always been, is to ensure we can assess with a high degree of confidence how we interpret the current data, and most importantly, how are we allocating our personal money. We remain firmly a one on the CAS scale. The risk-reward profile of broad-based traditional risk assets is, in our view, deeply unattractive, and we're going to talk about the why behind that and what we're excited about as well. So, first section is the war the world has stopped worrying about. Writing this letter has actually been one of the hardest things to do over the last 25 years. Every time we start, it seems like the story changes dramatically enough that the letter's going to be obsolete before it's even sent to investors. We're finally at a place to where we want to get this in your hands, and so we charge forward knowing that things could be materially different, potentially within the next few weeks or the next few days even. On February 28th, 2006, the United States and Israel launched coordinated strikes on Iran, targeting nuclear and military infrastructure. It's hard because the fact that I pause because it's hard to even imagine that at the beginning of this year, if we had projected and said that there was going to be this kind of a conflict, this much war, and this much of a disruption, that literally we would be talking about it as though it's really not been that big of a deal. But I want to stress that this is literally one of the largest military actions that has occurred in decades. And, got to go back all the way to really the initial Gulf War to have this kind of magnitude of something occurring, and yet the markets have basically almost ignored it. I'm going to continue with the letter, but that's the advantage of you listening to the audio is you get a little bit of extra color commentary, if you will. I just couldn't resist it when I was reading here. Just, it's mind-boggling to think about. But so after the United States and Israel launched the coordinated strikes, Iran declared the Strait of Hormuz effectively closed to Western Allied shipping. Tanker traffic collapsed. On March 7th, a single commercial vessel sailed through the strait. The historical daily average is 138 ships. Think about that, 138 to 1. And now, of course, we know that the United States has actually closed off the strait after Iran saying that they were closing the strait. So we're, sealing that now, and the United States has made sure that nothing travels out of there. What happened next in the oil markets by any historical measure was extraordinary. Brent crude began 2026, and I would encourage you to go look at the charts that we have online. Even if you're listening to this, which we appreciate you doing, you need to see the charts in this particular letter. It's really, really important. So Brent crude began 2026 at $61 per barrel after rising tension pushes prices to 72 by February 27th. The conflicts triggered the single largest quarterly oil price increase on an inflation-adjusted basis since at least 1988. Prices reached nearly $120 per barrel at their peak, a 65% increase in less than 2 weeks. March 2026 was one of the largest single-month oil price surges on record, with Brent crude gaining 51% in the month alone. And as of this writing, Brent trades currently around $107 per barrel. The strait remains closed. The IEA's warned the market could not, get back to full supply or just remain materially undersupplied through October, even if a resolution is reached next month. Now, in practical terms, most people don't really fully appreciate what the Strait of Hormuz means to the world. The chart, this is going to be really, really tough to articulate, but I'm going to do my best. So what the chart shows, it shows China, India, Japan, South Korea, Europe, other Asia, and the United States, and how much exposure each of those countries has to the Strait of Hormuz. So how much of their national crude imports do they get from that area? And so, as an example, the most extreme is Japan. Japan gets 92% of all of their crude imports from the Strait of Hormuz. India at 88%, South Korea at 74%, China at 55%, Europe's at 14%. Other Asia would be 62%, and the United States gets 2%. So in 2025, approximately 20 million barrels of crude oil transited the Strait of Hormuz every single day, roughly 25% of all the seaborne oil trade in the world, and 20% of total world consumption. Japan gets 90 to 92% of its crude from the Middle East. And the amazing thing is that when you think about all these other countries that I mentioned, they have to get their crude from there. They don't have anywhere else to get it from. The United States, by contrast, only takes 2% from the Strait of Hormuz. 15 years ago, that was 20%, and the difference has been the domestic shale production. And this is the discrepancy we described in our March 2026 special update to partners that, if you haven't watched, you should watch. Americans feel this crisis primarily at the gas pump. I mean, it's real. But people in Japan, South Korea, Germany, and India are living a very different fundamental story because they just aren't able to get what they need as much as they really can't get what they need. Just a simple way to put that. The bypass problem makes the situation structurally fragile. So what does that mean? So there are some of the countries over there in the Middle East that have the ability to actually use a pipeline to be able to divert supply from the Strait of Hormuz and take it somewhere else. So Saudi and the UAE have pipelines. They can move 3.5 to 5 million, barrels a day, 3.5 to 5.5 million barrels a day. So that's a good chunk of the 20 million that goes out, but certainly that means the other side of the equation is at 14 to 65 million barrels a day are locked to Hormuz. They don't have any other way to get out. So it's something to where you have countries, literally like five of them: Iraq, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, and Iran, have zero meaningful bypass infrastructure, with 14 to 16.5 million barrels a day literally having to all go through this 4-mile-wide passage. The IEA, International Energy, has called this the largest supply disruption in the recorded history of the global oil market. So there's three different layers of economic damage here. Layer one, the commodity tax. Obviously, every dollar per barrel above the pre-conflict levels is a direct cost that impacts consumers and businesses. U.S. average retail gasoline hit almost $4 a gallon by March 30th. Diesel reached $5.40 per gallon. For a consumer who's already under some financial stress, and again, I state, you wouldn't know it by looking at all the luxury hotels, but if you look at what's happening in the world of every other consumer, for the most part, there's a lot of stress out there, folks. And these are not trivial numbers when you take somebody's costs to fill up their gas tanks up that high. The spike in inflation also puts the central banks around the world in an even larger predicament, as they would like to lower interest rates to aid the economy, but that could ignite even more inflation pressures. And once again, the Federal Reserve is in a box. Layer two is the uncertainty premium. Sustained geopolitical risk delays decisions. Capital expenditures, get postponed. Hiring freezes get implemented as precautions, acquisition discussions extend timelines. Aggregated across thousands of companies all around the world, these individual pauses become economic drag before they become a formal recession, which we're not calling for that, but certainly it could be. Layer three is the global discrepancy. When Japan, South Korea, India, and Germany are operating in crisis mode, just as an example, the United States is not immune from the consequences. Europe's business confidence surveys tell a measurably more cautious story than their American counterparts. The insulation the United States enjoys does not mean the risks are contained. It means we may be among the last to feel them. So here's a quote from Roy Johnson of the Commodity Context in April. This is the largest oil supply shock in the history of the oil market. So the ripple effects are real, and they're going to continue to work through the economy over the next several months and quarters. So the second section is the hollowing out continues. So in our third quarter 2025 letter, we introduced the concept of the hollowing out of the American workforce, a structural AI-driven reshaping of white-collar employment concentrated squarely in the middle of the income ladder. We said that this was no longer theoretical. The first 4 months of 2026 had made the case more forcefully than any letter that we could write. To hear the numbers, total layoffs in the United States in the first 4 months of 26 was approximately 300,000, according to outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas. That is 50% lower than the same period a year ago, when government workforce restrictions dominated the conversation and private sector layoffs were 10% below the prior year. Remember, a year ago, obviously everything was happening at the government level and you had this massive drop of layoffs that occurred related to the DOGE efforts, et cetera. And so now we're looking at the year-over-year comparisons, but private sector layoffs were down 10% versus prior year. And some people think that's reassuring because on the surface it's like, okay, layoffs are down 10% from a year ago. But if you look beneath it, and the picture will change quite dramatically. So technology sector layoffs are surging. Technology companies eliminated more than 85,000 positions in the first 4 months of 2026 alone. That's a 33% increase over the same period in 25. And critically, the companies doing this are not in distress. They're posting record revenues. They're profitable, well-capitalized organizations making deliberate, premeditated decisions about how much human labor their AI-augmented operating business models require. So literally this past week, we saw the largest of these kinds of what I consider to be a bit of a canary in the coal mine. On May 14th, 2026, just days before I wrote this letter and record this, Cisco Systems delivered one of the clearest illustrations of the structural shift we've been describing. Cisco reported $15.8 billion in revenue for the third quarter, a 12% year-over-year increase that beat estimates. Product revenue rose 17%. The company raised its full guidance to $63 billion roughly, up from $56.7 billion the prior year. Its stock, already trading at record highs, jumped more than 16% on the news. But yet, at the same time, Cisco announced nearly 4,000 job cuts. A significant number. It's not that big for their total workforce, but it's still a very large number of people. I mean, again, these are 4,000 people and 4,000 families. And the CEO, Chuck Robbins, sent employees a publicly shared email explaining the rationale, and the logic was unambiguous. Quote, "The companies that will win in the AI era will be those with focus, urgency, and the discipline to continuously shift investment," keyword, investment, "toward the areas where demand and long-term value creation are the strongest. This means making hard decisions about where we invest, how we're organized, and how our cost structure reflects the opportunity in front of us." Now, read that carefully. Cisco is not cutting people because business is bad. Cisco is cutting people because business is so good that it has the confidence to reallocate the capital those salaries represented toward AI investment. The company explicitly plans to expand its secure AI factory with NVIDIA. The company directly cited robust demand for AI infrastructure as the driver of product revenue growth. And I'll reiterate this, and it'll go directly to the quote from the CEO. Continuously shift investment toward the areas where demand and long-term value creation are strongest. Translation, that ain't people. Right? That's hard to hear, but that is the reality. They are saying we need to not spend as much money on people and we need to spend more money on AI. That's going to make the people that are left much more efficient. That's great. But what about the 4,000 families that are affected by that? What are we going to do with them? It's a conversation for another day. But the Cisco CEO follows in the footsteps of the Block CEO, Jack Dorsey, who cut 40% of his workforce in the first quarter, saying, while AI tools have basically advanced so fast, it has changed how you run a company. And Atlassian, I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly, CEO, who called it disingenuous to pretend AI does not change the number of roles a company requires. These are not euphemisms. These are CEOs of healthy, growing businesses explaining precisely why they need fewer people. Now, here's the question that nobody is asking, and I do not understand at all why people are not asking this question. We believe this question deserves more attention than it's receiving in the financial press. If companies are letting people go in order to invest in AI, and that AI investment is generating productivity gains that eliminate the need to rehire, what would cause that company or other companies a new cycle of hiring to begin? What would cause companies to say, oh, I no longer need to cut people to invest in AI. The AI makes us more productive. So therefore, I'm going to stop cutting people and now I need to hire a bunch of people again. Right? In prior technology cycles, the answer was straightforward. Automation of one category of work created new categories of work. The ATM eliminated some bank teller roles, for sure, but it created more branches, more loan officers, and more customer service roles. The spreadsheet eliminated some accounting positions, but it created more financial analysts. The pattern held across nearly every wave of productivity technology has brought in modern history. Displacement in one area created demand in another. And that is what we continue to hear from the financial press and all of those who want that to be true this time as well. But the AI cycle may be different in a very critical way. Prior technology tools were instruments. They required human operators to deploy them. AI is beginning to operate as a collaborator, capable of handling the very coordination and judgment tasks that created white-collar employment in the first place. When a company like Cisco can grow revenue 12% year-over-year while cutting headcount, and its stock rises 16% in a single day on that news, the market is sending a clear message. Investors are rewarding the trade. Listen carefully. Investors are rewarding the trade of people for AI, not questioning it. This is not a prediction that human employment ends, so don't misquote me on this. It is an observation that the mechanism which historically drove rehiring, where growth created new categories that needed work, is under pressure in a way it has not been before. Until that question has a clear answer, the hollowing out of the American middle class, white-collar workforce, and that around the world is a structural concern, not a cyclical one. These are not struggling companies making desperate cuts. These are thriving companies making strategic decisions. And that difference makes an enormous impact for what comes next. So we'll write more about this in the future. Section three is a market that has stopped asking the hard questions. The S&P 500 continues to reach for new highs. And we ask, as we always do, who is doing the work? Meaning, what is driving those new highs? And the chart here is one you need to see. You need to get online and look at it. The chart above tells a story that a single data point cannot. Today's top 10 companies represent 38.4% of the entire S&P 500, a level of concentration that is no modern precedent. At the dot-com peak in 2000, widely regarded as most concentrated and speculative market of the modern era, the top 10 represented 27.1% of the index. We're now more than 11 percentage points above that prior extreme. To put it differently, Investors who today buy a simple S&P 500 index fund are placing more than a third of their capital in just those 10 companies. The other 490 companies in the index share the remaining 61.6% of exposure. And those 10 companies are overwhelmingly, the top 10 companies, are overwhelmingly AI beneficiary names trading at valuations that price in decades of flawless execution. More than 62% of the S&P 100 trades at greater than 30 times earnings. Only six of the largest companies in America trade below 10 times earnings. Think about that. Only six of the 100 largest trade below 10 times earnings. And so we call this the breadth warning, not breath, but breadth, which is the amount of companies that are participating, if you will. So the advanced decline line measures actual participation of individual stocks in any market move. When the AD line, advanced decline line, AD line, the AD line declines even as the major indices make new highs, it signals that the index is being carried by a handful of very large names while the majority quietly deteriorates beneath the surface. History has given us two unmistakable examples of where this can lead. In 1999, the New York Stock Exchange advanced decline line peaked before the NASDAQ crashed 49%. In 2007, the AD line peaked approximately 6 months before the top that preceded the financial crisis that we saw the market come fall by 57%. So today, the S&P 500 makes new highs while the underlying advanced decline picture fails to confirm the move. We're not predicting an outcome. We're observing that the internal structure of the current rally carries the fingerprints of both prior market peaks. And history does not repeat exactly, but as we've said so many times over 25 years, it has an uncomfortable tendency to rhyme. So it's a data point that we're very focused on. The next one is the dividend yield. Again, a chart you need to see. 100 years of history. The S&P 500 dividend yield stands at approximately 1.07% as of this writing, the lowest in recorded history. The prior low was approximately 1.1%, reached briefly in, when? 2000. The 100-year historical average is 4.3%. The developed world ex the U.S. yields 2.8%. The 10-year U.S. Treasury yields more than 4.5%. An investor today collects a nearly risk-free return of 4.5% from government bonds versus a dividend yield of 1.07% from equities, while taking on dramatically more volatility and concentration risk. That's not a normal relationship. Next chart, can't even describe it, really. I'll try, but you need to see it. It shows how the relationship between starting yields and the following decade return. And the relationship between the starting yield and subsequent decade returns is one of the most durable patterns in financial history. Those who bought near the 1.1% yield level in 2000, the last time we were here, experienced the lost decade, with the index delivering negative price returns for 10 years. We're now at an all-time record low yield. Now, we're not predicting another lost decade. We're saying the starting conditions are as unfavorable as they have ever been, which is another reason why the CAS scale remains firmly at a one. By virtually every historical measure we can access, the risk-reward profile of broad-based traditional risk assets is deeply unattractive. Section 4, do not paint with too broad a brush. Private credit is not a monolith. We've received a ton of questions about private credit. The topic is being discussed in the popular press in ways that generate more heat than light, and we'll attempt to provide some clarity. What's actually happening? The headlines are not wrong at all that risks exist. Defaults are rising in some segments. Some borrowers are struggling, and we're particularly concerned about the consumer. The rapid growth of private credit over the last decade has inevitably produced some loans underwritten more aggressively than the underlying cash flows warranted. That is a true statement, and anyone who tells you otherwise is not being straight with you. What is not true is the inference that often follows, that private credit is broadly impaired, that every manager faces the same exposure, and that the category should be approached with uniform caution. That conclusion is just too simple, and acting on it indiscriminately would be a mistake. So who is actually defaulting? Most of the high-profile defaults have not come from AI-disrupted software companies. They have come from fraud. Businesses that became over-leveraged relative to the cash flows, companies led by management teams that lacked the skill to navigate a higher rate environment, and situations where capital was deployed without adequate discipline at the margin. These are lending failures. They're specific, they're identifiable, and they're largely avoidable through due diligence. The AI disruption question in enterprise software is real and worth monitoring carefully. But the question of who wins and loses in that reshaping will not be answered this quarter or this year. For lenders underwriting to yesterday's growth rates, it definitely creates risk. For lenders underwriting to today's cash flows and today's collateral values with appropriate structural protections, the picture is fundamentally different. They share a category name. They do not share the same risk profile. Not all private credit is equal. The analysis required to distinguish between them demands that looking at individual loan portfolios, borrower by borrower, lender by lender, not by reading headlines. At CAS, we spent 25 years acquiring the expertise to make those distinctions. We exited nearly all of our private credit exposure at the end of 2024. Simply because we just did not see a favorable risk reward. Today, we're becoming more interested in what we are seeing and will consider episodic opportunities where there is material mispricing. The current environment is producing some attractive entry points in specific segments, precisely because the broad brush narrative is causing some investors to panic and leave the opportunity behind. Not that many opportunities yet, but they're starting to show themselves, and we're going to be ready when they do. Section 5, we are building. Earlier this year, we celebrated our 25th year and the opening of our new headquarters. Last month, we shared a detailed update with partners on initiative to drive significant enhancements to our fund operations and investor experience. We're excited to share the first fruits of that labor, which has been an all-consuming lift for our team in the next few months. The changes we are making reflect a deliberate, years-in-the-making effort to be an even better partner to our 9,000 plus investors across all 50 states and 43 countries. We have significant initiatives planned for the summer and the early fall of 2026, and we look forward to sharing them as they come to fruition. We continue to operate with the mindset that we're a 25-year-old startup. Please help us accomplish these objectives by referring world-class talent to us. We're adding to our team in every single department, and you'd likely know or work with people in the industry who are outstanding at what they do and would be a cultural fit for us. Help them connect with us so they can discover how they can strive to develop into the very best version of themselves they can be by becoming a member of the CAS family. We invest our personal capital in everything we do alongside yours. The CAS scale, these letters, the phone calls, the themes events, they're all expressions of the same commitment we made in August of 2001. To be honorable, disciplined, and aligned in everything we do. The world is complicated right now. Markets are pricing in a degree of calm that we do not believe the underlying data supports. That does not mean the next move is the markets are going to be down or that it happens tomorrow. It just means it is not a moment that we should be taking for granted, and there should not be complacency in the way in which we're investing our capital. We're grateful for the trust you place in us. We're excited about what this firm is becoming. Our best work is ahead of us. All our very best. Thank you for joining us. We look forward to talking to you soon.